Today we speak to Dr. Sarah Best and Dr. Saskia Freytag, laboratory heads of the Brain Cancer Research Lab from Australia's Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. In this episode, they share their views and interests for tackling high-grade glioma by dissecting its heterogeneity and its interactions with the microenvironment. They also discuss why spatial biology was key to uncover subtype-specific heterogeneity and how they combine the power of GeoMx DSP and CosMx SMI to maximize their understanding of this cancer type.
This is the Spatial Navigator podcast brought to you by NanoString. Here at NanoString, we believe that spatial genomics is at the forefront of discovery and translational biology research. We present the work that researchers are doing in the field and share our initiatives to engage and support them. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Saskia. Thank you so much for joining on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Could I get both of you to share your journeys to research? And then a follow-up question would be, what was your inspiration to study the brain and for Saskia to focus on bioinformatics?
Well, I can start. I'm Dr. Saskia Freytag, and I'm a computational biologist, and I co-lead the Brain Cancer Research Laboratory with Dr. Sarah Best, who's next to me, and Dr. Jim Whittle, who's a neuro-oncologist. And I am by training a statistician and actually dropped biology in year 10 and had like a long journey back towards biology. So I think I was always really fascinated that with statistics, you could tell a story with numbers and data and graphs. And that when you focus that lens onto the human body, then we can really learn about ourselves and sort of what makes us human. And that directly sort of goes into why I also chose to focus on the brain, probably actually much earlier than Sarah, funnily enough, in my research. So I've always been super interested in the complexity of the human brain and what it tells us about being human, because I mean, we all know that the brain is a very unique organ. It's very different to other organisms. It's the most different organ that we have to other organisms. And that's, I think, why it makes it really interesting to study.
Yeah, I think as Saskia alluded to, I got into the brain later than her. So I'm a fundamental biologist. I'm in the wet lab and my training has all been in cancer research. So throughout my career, I've worked on different types of solid cancers. And in the last 7 or 8 years, my focus has been on low survival cancers, and that's taken me to a few different places, but that really is what harnessed the focus for me onto brain cancer, because treatment hasn't changed for brain cancer patients in over 2 decades. The survival outcome for patients with brain cancer is extremely poor compared to all other different types of cancer. And so it's really an area that needs attention and needs additional research focus.
For a researcher who isn't focused on the brain, as a sort of too long didn't read, can you steelman or make the case for research of the brain?
So as I said, the brain is what makes us uniquely human and defines our human experience, really. It's difficult to study in model organisms because of that, because of how it evolved. And looking at mice isn't going to tell us much about, you know, our feelings and other things. They're important, mice, but it's difficult to extrapolate to a human experience from a model organism. And when things go wrong in the brain, such as brain cancer, then we're faced with one-of-a-kind challenges that, again, are not very well modeled in model organisms. So we face a difficulty in accessing tissue repeatedly, particularly. So when we look at breast cancer, we can look at how the tumor evolves over time. We cannot do that in brain cancer, unfortunately, because people don't often let us operate multiple times on them without an explicit need for that operation to occur. We have a specialized immune system in the brain that we haven't really understood much about. And we are currently learning a ton about that immune system and how it interacts with the rest of the immune system in the body. And it's actually a really exciting time in that field. But that makes it a really challenging organism for when things are going wrong. And it's sort of the final frontier, really, for us in biology to really understand that and then be able to treat all these ailments that are really driving society sort of mad at the moment. We have a lot of mental illness. We have dementia is a big problem. And so it's it's important that we understand how the brain really works and how we can start to treat these illnesses.
For those who aren't well-versed in spatial, how did you start out with it? And could you walk me through how you felt when it was cognizant that there were these capabilities?
So I'm really interested in the heterogeneity of tumors and how within one tumor, we have many different tumor cells that have their own discrete properties, and also how those conversations between tumor cells occur with other cell types in the tumor microenvironment, which is really rich. And we've talked a little bit about immune cells, and there are many other cell types as well. So I was really interested in adopting spatial transcriptomics to really look at that heterogeneity at a deeper level than immunohistochemical staining. And I think, you know, this is new territory for me. So my previous research hasn't been in big data, big transcriptomics projects. So this was really different. So it was great to work directly with Saskia on the project. And I think the aha moment for me was really embarrassingly simple of just putting a pie chart of all the different cell states within the regions of interest and just seeing across the tissue how different that was within these spatially discrete locations.
How did you come up with the specific research questions that led to the preprint? And congratulations on that preprint. I read it and it was fantastic.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think it's very much driven by what Sarah talked about previously, about the idea really to interrogate heterogeneity and in particular see how tumor cell state in brain cancer changes throughout different brain cancers from different patients, but also within one tumor, and really interrogating that and seeing what immune cells will co-occur with different tumor cell states. And I think that's where really it was very important to have access to the CosMx.
And it was really one of the very first experiments that we performed in the lab, the first GeoMx slides. And that question was almost even more simple, was just to compare the amount of heterogeneity in high-grade gliomas that did or did not have mutation in IDH1, which is a clinically significant mutation. So it started out as a really basic question. And it just kind of, yeah, really evolved and rapidly turned into a really exciting project.
So then perhaps we could talk about an overview of the main findings and their significance for understanding the microenvironment of high-grade gliomas.
So I guess it will be listeners who know anything about brain cancer won't be surprised that glioblastoma had a really high level of heterogeneity. It's one of the hallmarks of glioblastoma. But the degree of spatial heterogeneity that we saw was really striking. And ultimately, we found that tumor states in glioblastoma interacted differently with each other and with the immune microenvironment. So we found that tumor states that closely resembled normal glial cells in the brain interacted closely with microglia, which are a specialized macrophage that's native to the brain. So they'll recognize each other more easily. But in contrast, tumor cell states that had diverged further away from normal glial cells, they really interacted with immune cells that were coming in from the circulation, such as monocytes or lymphocytes. So seeing and understanding these niches really plays an important role in understanding the plasticity of glioblastoma and identifying candidates for therapies such as immunotherapy, which really rely on the interaction between tumor cells and the immune system.
How might your findings about the oligodendrocytic lineage dominance in IDH1 mutant glioma affect our understanding of the cell of origin of these tumors?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. And prefaces, we have obviously not done any experiments on cell of origin here, so we can at best speculate. So in our IDH1 mutant cohort, we ended up having two astrocytomas and one oligodendroglioma that was kind of a surprise to us because we thought we had an astrocytoma because that's what the pathology reports initially indicated. And then using the GeoMx, actually, we were able to identify that we had an 1Q19Q co-deletion, and that was indicative of an oligodendroglioma, which was later on confirmed. And all these three tumors had a really high percentage of oligodendrocytic tumor cell state in them. And that really speaks to the plasticity of tumor cell states. And it will drive further questions whether these are really tumors that are derived more from like an oligodendrocytic precursor cell state. Again, we have to go into preclinical models. That's where Sarah comes in and does her beautiful mouse work to really understand that.
Since you mentioned the DSP, can you describe how the DSP and SMI individually contributed and added perspective to the study of the microenvironment?
So we started with the DSP, which really gave us this great sense of variability across patients, but also within patients, and really led to us developing some hypotheses about what cell types were interacting with each other once we had done deconvolution on the DSP data possible. And NanoString has some beautiful tools for that. So these hypotheses we wanted to investigate further and to be able to validate. And you can do this with immunostaining, which is limited, obviously, because you know you have to find the right marker for the right cell type. And then you can only do so many at the same time. So it really gives you a limited picture. So CosMx was sort of the natural conclusion of where we needed to go in order to validate some of this. We did CosMx on one of our GBMs that's in the paper. We actually also did it on one of the oligodendrogliomas, but that's data that isn't out yet. And we were able to drill further down into what cell types are really close to each other, how may they interact with each other, and really validate a lot of the things that we had seen in the DSP and the GeoMx data, but also really drill down using only a very limited number of individuals, in this case, just one.
And I suppose, like, how does the intratumoral heterogeneity observed in both glioma types affect, does that impact our current understanding as it stands? Or does it change from what is typically in the literature?
Yeah, I think the intratumoral heterogeneity that we identified is consistent with the literature, which has used a number of other types of techniques, such as single-cell RNA-seq and Visium and others. So I guess in a broad sense, we weren't surprised, but being able to see it at that single-cell resolution and really see the spatial distances that we're looking at, that's really kind of where we honed in.
Yeah, I think that's the surprising fact. It's how immense that heterogeneity is. We knew about the heterogeneity, but sort of the extent of it wasn't clear. And the second part to it is really the discovery of these niches wasn't really possible with technologies that were doing essentially kind of mini bulks and is really only possible with something that allows you to have single cell res.
I suppose like an analogy would be like, because you've taken that ROI or AOI and sort of like created an aggregate shade of that AOI, you don't get to appreciate all the individual colors that are occurring.
Absolutely, that's exactly right. You get somewhat of an understanding and you can develop these hypotheses, but then you never feel exactly sure because you don't have that level of resolution, and really seeing is believing in this case.
So I guess with the differences, where do you feel the instruments sit in the workflow and what would you say their purposes are?
Yeah, I think that closely builds on to what Saskia was saying, that the DSP, it answered a really broad question and it was really important for hypothesis building. Something that we were able to do with it that we haven't been able to do with other technologies was we labeled our tumor cells with Ki-67 as well, which marks proliferating cells. So using the DSP technology, we were able to really look at the differences in our tumor cells that were dividing compared to those that were not dividing. And so that also built in additional implications in terms of heterogeneity as well. So the DSP might really kind of allowed us to see what do we want to look at more closely. And so we performed validation studies on independent data sets from bulk and single cell and other spatial data sets. We performed immunostaining, and I think the SMI was really important to really not just then validate the DSP, but then also it kind of opened up its whole next set of hypotheses for future projects.
And that was meaningful to estimate the prevalence of progenitor and mesenchymal cell lineages, which actually sort of brought in that immunotherapeutic element, so that with the increased infiltration and circulating immune cells, there might be an avenue for immunotherapies in the future, would you say?
Yeah, so we found in that proliferating cell subset, that's really where all of our progenitor tumor cell states were captured. And we also saw an increase in the proportion of mesenchymal tumor cell states as well. And then using the SMI, really investigating the tumor microenvironment around the mesenchymal cell states, that's where we found a lot of those infiltrating immune cells as well. So our T cells, NK cells, dendritic cells, monocytes, and bone marrow-derived macrophages. And so all of those different immune compartments are really important when we're thinking about immunotherapy. And there had been a previous study looking at a dendritic cell-based immunotherapy where there was some hypothesis around patients with an increased proportion of the mesenchymal cell state could benefit more than others. And so our study really just elevates that and really shows why would that be the case.
Since we're talking about that, could you walk us through why it's already difficult to use things like immunotherapies or effective diagnostics and treatment strategies for glioma patients, why that's the case?
I think what we have learned and what makes us a bit hesitant is that if we only use a bit of the piece of the tumor in order to identify sort of what are the most prevalent tumor cell states that a patient has in their tumor, then we might actually be missing things. So because of how quickly the tumor cell state changes across the tumor, I think we need to have different approaches, really. And I guess, you know, you could think about crushing up your entire resection and then putting it through either bulk RNA or single cell RNA sequencing. But that's often not possible because some of it will go towards sections and towards pathology. And it's actually, most of these samples will be cut up. So I think we certainly believe that in the future, pathology needs to go towards a more spatial approach and that is deeper than just immunostaining.
I think as you were saying, like the most prevalent cell type, it ties back to that pie chart that you're talking about because your eyes will be drawn to the largest section of the pie chart, but then you miss all the different nuances in the small sections that are significant and could push things like resistance. As a result of these challenges, what is a typical course of action for a high-grade glioma patient?
Yeah, unfortunately, it hasn't changed. And our publication is just a first step towards hopefully changing this in the future. So typically, our patients get a regime of temozolomide and chemotherapy after their tumor has been resected, if that is possible. It depends on where the tumor sits in the brain of whether this is going to agree with the patient or not, or leave neurological deficits that would really impact their life tremendously. And hence, that wouldn't be an option for these patients. But yeah, this has really been the case for 30 years now, that this is sort of the approach and nothing has changed, unfortunately. We've seen now some immunotherapies coming in, but that's for a small number of patients, unfortunately, and not for a lot of patients. So we really do need to make these fundamental discoveries now to change treatment in the future.
Since we talked about mesenchymal lineage cells, can you discuss the potential use of immunotherapeutic approaches like CAR T or a checkpoint inhibitor or dendritic cell therapies for patients with a high proportion of mesenchymal cells?
I think when we're thinking about personalized therapeutic approaches and not just in brain cancer, but in many other types of cancers where that's more of a mainstay of treatment, we want to really be cognizant about what is present in the tumor and whether that's mutation status or tumor cell state that can drive some of those treatment decisions. I think that's really important. I think our study highlights the potential utility of looking at the mesenchymal signature and having some kind of treatment decision, hopefully in the future, related to immunotherapy. In the converse, if a patient has no mesenchymal cells and there's really poor immune infiltration, then you would want to abandon immunotherapy type approaches for those patients. So I think it's equally as important to identify patients who maybe would benefit more from certain treatment options, but also to guide those away from treatment options that might not be beneficial.
Did you face any challenges when adapting your bioinformatic tools to analyze spatial data? And I think, Sarah, you alluded to this when you were talking about the realization of how huge these data sets would get.
Yeah, so I think spatial data is still in its infancy. Doing any analysis on these large data sets comes with huge challenges at the moment, but we're hoping that will get better. So the computational approaches and tools that are out there, they are still sort of in an alpha version, as I would call them. They are often poorly documented, unfortunately, They're still under active development, so things do change rather rapidly, and that can really interfere with analysis. So I think you have to be on top of that. You have to be able to try things out and be okay with making errors, because those tools might still change and they might still discover that they haven't really worked it out quite yet. And lastly, I think there's no benchmarking yet. We don't know what tools are good and what tools are maybe not so good. And so until we actually get to that place, and that's typically the work of bioinformaticians, where we really benchmark these things thoroughly on test data sets, where we have some sort of ground truth, before we have that, it'll be a bit of sort of the Wild West.
And I think the way that you're talking about it, it makes me think keeping a logbook and keeping copies of raw data, or even like step changes for redundancy, is important, especially as perhaps the tools might not be as reliable as you'd like.
It's about good work practices such as reproducibility, obviously, version control, and all of these other things that we are used to. But I think it's also more than that, it's not just a blind belief in what you're using, but really investigating what these tools are doing. And that can be hindered by the poor documentation that we currently are still seeing.
So based on your findings on the preprint, what are the next research questions that you have?
Answer this from sort of my computational lens. And to me, I was really fascinated by the niche analysis that we had done and the different niches that we identified. So with niches, it reminds me sort of ecology, where we often look at different habitats, such as a forest and a desert. And what is really interesting is not just the forest and the desert, but it's actually where the forest meets the desert. And that's where we see the interesting behaviors that animals have. We see new species potentially that have really adapted to just that very niche environment. To use niche again, to make that really confusing. And we also observe interactions between animals that we may not be seeing normally. And this is kind of what I would love to investigate, is look at where we have different tumor niches meet each other and whether there is anything weird going on there and whether interactions there are different and what that might tell us about how tumors spread or how we may be able to treat tumors.
Sarah, do you have anything to add?
I think from the biology point of view, it's kind of looking at these spatial interactions and niches over time and how that changes in response to treatment, how we can alter the plasticity of tumor cells and visualize that, which are experiments that could be done in longitudinal patient studies, such as what Jim's performing in the clinic. Or in preclinical mouse work as well, where we can take tumors over time and really treat them and see how the plasticity can change. And I think looking at that spatially will really close a few gaps in terms of our understanding of tumor heterogeneity.
How do you envision the future of high-plex spatial molecular imaging in high-grade gliomas? And let's not limit it to the brain, but the wider medical field.
I guess we're going to see more of it. That's my first answer. It's really revolutionized the field. Kind of like when single cell came around and that revolutionized the field. And I think I was probably one of the most skeptical people thinking that location wasn't important. But I think once you see what it can tell you and you know that proximity of cells does actually matter, you're going to be probably one of the converted, just like myself. So hopefully what we're going to be seeing in future studies is just more bigger sample sizes are going to be essential for spatial data, so we can compare across patients. And then also hopefully the ability to look a little bit further into the third dimension, into the Z-stack, and potentially by using adjacent sections or improved technology as well, that we really can have a look at how the tumor structure looks in three dimensions, because sometimes we will miss things in two dimensions where we underestimate typically the proximity of cell types.
What are some limitations of the current study and how do you plan to address them in future studies?
It's small sample size and that's just a cost issue, right? And we're going to try really hard to use some smart techniques to potentially put multiple tissue sections on one slide. That's one thing that we can try. but it's about getting more funding essentially to increase sample sizes. And that's where we were, I think, at the start of single cell sequencing as well. So this, we know that this process is coming and we know that this is a big limitation.
And what are your thoughts on the interdisciplinary collaboration between biologists, bioinformaticians, and clinicians?
I mean, I think it's essential. I think you probably can't do much research these days without having that type of strong collaboration in place. I think coming from the perspective of co-running a lab with Saskia, bioinformatician, and Jim, a neuro-oncologist, really designing these experiments together from the beginning, I think, is something that I probably not appreciated enough in past projects, but also just the importance of fostering good collaborations, good communication, having trust and respect for each other, I think is really essential. You know, and everyone has brought such a big part to the project. It couldn't have been done with, you know, three different people sitting in separate rooms, not really talking except to hone manuscript images, which is, you know, Sasi, you can probably speak to the classic interaction of a researcher and a bioinformatician. So I think it really is changing the way that we think about collaboration and drawing everyone together.
Yeah, I think I'm just so much more invested in this project because I've been there from the start and I was allowed to co-design this experiment, and that changes my investment in what is going on and means in the end that I will work so much harder as a computational biologist, quite frankly, on this project. I think that's just how humans work. And if you can harness that innate drive, then that's a good thing and you can get so much more out.
And for a researcher considering a spatial experiment for their whatever sample type they're looking at, what would you say they should consider and what should they avoid? So a piece of advice and a warning against a pitfall.
So my piece of advice is to involve two key collaborators, and that's a pathologist, to pick your interesting regions that you want to investigate and drive your research questions. Just doing the whole slide is going to be a computational nightmare and also is probably not giving you that targeted design that you really want for an experimental study. So find a collaborator that is a pathologist. And then the next one is involve your bioinformatician or your computational biologist really early on in the research project in order to avoid pitfalls again of experimental design, but also to, you know, make them part of the process and get them to be as invested as I was in this project, really. I think that would be really helpful. And then the biggest pitfall to me is this need for individuals to have the whole transcriptome. I think if you keep thinking that you need the whole transcriptome, these SMI methods are not going to be very appealing to you. But I think that is probably a misconception of how the transcriptome works and how much redundancy there is in the transcriptome. And you will be surprised as to how much you get out even with a limited panel. So I would just say, give it a try. And you can always add a couple of custom genes if you really need to.
I agree with everything Saskia said. I would just add then that the clinical relationship is really important. We used patient slides. They need to be cut fresh. So your relationship with your friendly anatomical pathology department at your local hospital is really important. And in that patient selection and cutting the slides, I think we underestimate how challenging that can be sometimes. And I think the pitfall for me would be that there is so much data, the amount of information that it produces was overwhelming and it's hard to sift through. And I think that's where having good research questions is important, because if you go in there without a research question, you could go in 1,000 different directions and then kind of not move forward at all. So I think that's something Saskia and I really found, was that there was just so much to go through.
And I think you two are an example, or sort of an example, because when I asked about the research questions, it was like, oh, we just want to see the heterogeneity between the grades of gliomas. And it's a multi-year study that this is, right?
Yeah, this one is actually pretty quick. We've raced this one through. This is, I would say, one of my faster projects, which is sort of like a year, about a year time, which is record time for me, definitely.
I mean, in terms of, yeah, biology and projects, I think we started this study in probably November or December 2021. So it's really quick.
But I mean, I totally get that normally this would take a lot of time. And I think it's sort of the early adopter curse that we have here a bit, where we haven't investigated absolutely everything that we could with the data, but really were very driven by our research questions to a certain extent, but then did sometimes look left and right, maybe to our detriment, and it could have probably been out a couple of months earlier. But honestly, we were really, really focused on this one.
Yeah. And I think each figure, we could have written a whole paper from the data from each figure. I think we really just wanted to get out what was possible with the technology and then move into bigger sample size experiments. But kind of comes back to the overwhelming data bit. But
yeah, and I guess we were fortunate because we had some really exciting research highlights that we could make into a paper, which may not always happen, obviously.
Like having to sift through all the different bits of data and going through multiple analyses to get findings. If you had one feature that you would like to have added into either the DSP or the SMI, what would that be?
I mean, I think to us, metabolomics is really fascinating, and we would love to be able to study the altered metabolism in cancer better. So if we could do multi-omics on metabolites and gene expression at the same time in a spatial manner, that would be really, really elegant. We can obviously do it from adjacent sections at the moment, but that's not quite from the same cell. And that might be missing certain information. And obviously, it's going to be a lot harder to relate that information. So if we can do anything about that, that would be great. But I also understand that imaging might not be the right technology for metabolomics. So, you know, it's up to you guys.
It kind of doing these experiments just... our wish list is so long because we can see what we can do with it. And then I think one of the first things that we were asking about were methylation probes and being able to look at methylation spatially. And I still think that would be really neat.
So really multi-omics. We would love multi-omics in whatever form, whether it's metabolism, methylation, chromatin accessibility, all in a spatial manner. It's also interesting to think that we might not need this in the future. It might be that we can build artificial intelligence that can relate that information for us, so that once we read out one type of information, let's say the transcriptome, we can sort of with some accuracy infer what the metabolomics might be or what the methylation profile might have been. I think we're getting to that point where in the public domain, we have created enough data sets that when you have smart people training sort of large language models like ChatGPT, you might actually be getting to that point where we no longer need to do these expensive readouts.
Speaking of AI, I understand for some bioinformaticians, AI can be a dirty word. Saskia, what is your view on AI?
It's a great time. Like, this is absolutely the future and we cannot ignore it. That would be to our detriment. I had a conversation with my dad about this and I really liked the way that he was looking at it. And he said, when we were in school and the calculator came out, people were saying all these crazy things about how it would dumb us down, and downskilling was a word that he used. And obviously that didn't happen. We've just become faster at things. We all now use the calculator all the time. In fact, we use much crazier technology than a calculator now all the time. And yes, a certain amount of downskilling will happen. We are not as fast on arithmetic any longer than maybe my dad was when he was in school, but that doesn't mean that I am dumber or that I am downskilled. I just have different skills. And I think that's what we're going to see with these large language models or in general AI. We will just be using technology much, much differently, and hopefully we'll get faster and we'll develop some new skills.
Sort of like the human transposition into the new way of working with all these tools. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Sarah and Saskia. I look forward to seeing you again.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Spatial Navigator podcast, brought to you by NanoString. If you would like to know more about NanoString's product and panel offerings, or speak to a member of our staff, please visit nanostring.com. You may also get in touch with us through LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter, the links to which are in the description.